else?
It was Mother's Day. I made chocolate covered strawberries. I took my sister and I made chocolate covered strawberries and pieces of pineapple and oh man, I got a good one for you, Alan. My sister saw like a picture online on like Pinterest or something of like chocolate covered dill pickles.
Okay. Yep.
It's just the worst thing, Alan. It's so bad. I don't know why anyone would think that that's good. Welcome to Food Court. I'm Shale McDonald, and I'm here with Alan Sutterby.
Hi.
We're two chefs from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food, and we love to talk about it. So let's talk about it.
What do you want to talk about?
Well, Alan, this week, we actually have a little bit of follow-up.
Okay.
Got a couple of things. Listener Greg from Vancouver emailed us with a couple of topic suggestions, one of which was food porn.
Okay.
Which I think is kind of an interesting topic. I don't know. What do you think about the topic of food porn, Alan?
Okay. So food porn, isn't food porn just a way to describe a style of photographing or videoing or talking about food? Is that... There's not like a food porn channel or something that...
No, okay. Yeah. Like I think that that's right.
Okay.
But I also think that it's like sort of a food culture thing.
Right.
Like when I think about food porn, I think about like...
Gratuitous.
Yeah. Gratuitousness. Yeah, okay. So like things like Epic Mealtime or
yes,
something like
yeah.
that. You know, like they like... Channels like YouTube channels like that build their following on the back of food porn culture, I think mm-hmm. is what that is. So anyways, I don't know. I think it's I mean, it's not our topic for this week,
no.
But I think it might be an interesting topic for us to broach at some point.
Yeah, totally. To me, like Epic Mealtime would be, if you want to continue the analogy, would be like some kind of fetish within food porn. Like there's a lot of food porn that's a
yeah.
lot more
yeah.
Benign than Epic Mealtime, but yeah, it is to me. Yeah, the conversation for me would end up becoming like when we talk about food now in the age of Instagram and well, we're not really the age of the Food Network anymore, I would say, but
yeah,
in the age from the what you and I would call the golden age of the Food Network up until modern Instagram times, like when we talk about food, how much of it are we just talking about how it looks and like, and the kind
right.
of like novelty of it, as opposed to the actual authentic experience of eating it and sharing it with other people. But yeah.
Oh yeah. That's a really good point.
It's a very interesting
that's,
topic. Yeah.
Yeah. That's the crux of that topic there for sure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like how many things do you see on Instagram that you're never going to eat, but then you have this idea in your head of like what it would be like,
yeah.
or, you know,
and,
yeah.
and what kind of like the, like what percent of your, if you want to call it like interaction with the food community is just through images and those kinds of concepts without actually, like I said, the real experience of eating it.
Yeah.
Okay. Add it to the list.
Okay. It's going on the list right now. Stay tuned, listener, Greg, we're going to get to your topic one day. And then the other thing that I think is pretty hilarious is that I'm pretty sure it's in our last episode, which was
the real guilty pleasures. No, a couple of hidden gems.
Oh yeah, no, it was the episode before then. Yeah, it was the real guilty pleasures episode.
Yeah, about shaming, right?
Yeah. So you talked about shaming someone in the black box catering kitchen for bringing in coffee from like an external source. And that person was Jen who worked there, and listener Jen wrote in to let us know that actually seemingly your shaming worked because
I don't believe
she no longer brings like Starbucks into work when she goes to her current job.
but she had to change, like, so I shamed her.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not like the next day. Well, first of all, I don't think that I only brought it up once. I'm sure I brought it up multiple times. It didn't.
No, yeah, it was a long. It was a long term.
But it's not like
it was like it was. It was a long term inception, I think.
Because if it's true now that she doesn't get Starbucks every morning, like it's well after she's worked with me, and so I wonder if I'm actually the source of that change, or sorry, the inspiration for that change, or if something else. Did she give any other information about why?
I mean, my view on that, Alan, is that like if if you weren't at least a part of the source of her inspiration for changing her mind about that, then I doubt that when she heard us talk about it on the podcast that she would have reached out and been like, oh, actually, Alan, I did stop doing that.
But she didn't say thank you.
I can't remember if she thanked us or not. She probably thanked you. I'm pretty sure she thanked you.
Well, I just hope that I just want her to enjoy her coffee. So,
yeah, 100%. And I was actually really surprised because I think that I said in the episode that I was like, no, Jen's going to. And
right. Yeah.
So, you know, like, I wouldn't expect that shaming would even have any effect on her. So right. I found it pretty hilarious that she wrote in. Okay. Yeah. And just one other thing that I wanted to mention is our mutual friend, Erica Box, who's an amazing baker. She has her own bakery, and she ran the bakery at District Cafe for years. Mm-hmm. So our friend Erica has entered in an online contest at greatestbaker.com, and I think the grand prize is like $20,000, and she's trying to win that money to build out a bakery in the shop at her house. Mm-hmm. So that she can run her own bakery basically out of her home, which I think is a great cause, and I've been voting for her every day. You can go online and vote for her every day. If you want to know how to vote, you can look up her account on Instagram. Her account is Raisins and Saffron. Mm-hmm. On Instagram. So, hey, Erica. And if you know Erica, definitely go and vote for her every day. Mm-hmm. And I really hope she wins.
Yeah, she's making really amazing sourdough breads. I assume I don't know if this is under her Laneway Bakery moniker or not, but like her Laneway Bakery sourdough breads are basically unlike anything I've seen in Edmonton.
Yeah, no, they're amazing. Like lots of variety in terms of like inclusions and just like texture and flavor.
Interesting.
Are like,
yeah. Nigella seed. And she did a Hascap one a couple summers ago that really blew my brain. It was like you could slice it and toast it and put butter on it. And it was like having toast and jam, but the jam was already inside the bread. Tart Hascaps. And yeah, just like this crazy, I don't know how to describe it, but like moist. Yeah, the crumb of her sourdough is unlike anything I've seen in the city. It's really great.
Yeah. So good luck, Erica. Yeah. And moving right along, we actually do have our own topics to talk about tonight. Yeah. I know. Thanks for reminding me, right? And we're going to be talking about cooking myths, as I'm sure you already know if you read the title of this podcast. So what does that mean, Alan? Cooking myths, what are we going to talk about?
By cooking myths, we mean entrenched ideas that are not true or are not... We'll get to it, but like there's some where the technique that's described is a good technique to perform, but the reasons that are given for executing it that way are not correct.
Right. Also, I would say in some cases, the technique that it describes is maybe often not the best technique to use.
I'm curious to hear what examples you have.
Okay. So am I, actually. Maybe that's a false statement. I guess we'll find out.
Well, do you want to start with one?
Well, yeah, I don't know. Should we? Okay, so I would say, like, as per most of everything that I wind up talking about on this podcast, I would say like 75% of what I have on my list came from the internet.
Okay.
But I don't know. Did you do any Googling or internet research about like food myths or like, you know, kitchen myths, but to like prepare for the podcast?
So I wrote my long list, which only had, it had about 10 items on it from memory and experience. And then I did Google it to see if there was any interesting one that I had heard that I had missed. There was one. Not a particularly important one, I would say, but an interesting one, I guess, that that I added. But
yeah, well, I think that you mentioned this phenomenon on a previous episode, but like when I went and started Googling for it, mm-hmm. what I found was that basically on the entire internet, there's like one master list of things that people have sort of identified yeah. as being like kitchen myths or food myths, and everyone just copies that same list yeah. and then writes a different blog post about it.
Are you talking about how in our episode on creativity, I was talking about these aggregating websites that scrape the internet?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
It's shocking. It's truly shocking.
It's disappointing.
I've been blogging for, something say 12 years.
Yeah.
And so I feel like I've seen whatever. That's not like my grandpa would not be impressed with that sentence, but I feel like I've seen that kind of like, a bit of the history of blogging and everything. But to give you one example, like just Google, homemade Ritz crackers, like homemade, like that style, like it just means like you're referring to that's the style of Ritz crackers, like the really crispy, flaky, buttery cracker. And the uh-huh. first, I swear, certainly the first three and probably the first five returns that you get, the recipe is identical. They've clearly right. just copied from one source. They add their own pictures. They add some lame story at the start to like mm-hmm. lengthen the post and improve the SEO. But like it's garbage. Like it's just like...
Yeah, it's just plagiarism.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, sorry. So
yeah, it's disappointing. Yeah. And I have more to say about it too, but I don't really want to get us off track.
Yeah,
but anyway,
yeah.
You know, like that's definitely what I encountered when I tried to Google cooking myths. And I had a few that I sort of like thought of on my own. And I think that those are like the highlights of my list for sure. Mm. I guess like the reason why I brought it up is because I'm concerned that we're going to have the exact same list. Although you did say that you have 10 and I only have 7.
Okay.
So
do you want to just, can we start with what I think is the most famous one?
Sure. Yeah.
I don't know if you'll agree, but, it's funny that it's so famous because it's been so thoroughly, debunked and rebuked. But, certainly when I started cooking, there were still people who were telling me that, you sear meat to seal in the juices. So at the start of cooking, like whether it's steaks or whatever, you sear it at high temp to kind of cauterize the exterior and seal in the juices and then continue the cooking.
And then they can never get out. And so all that juice just stays in your steak until you cut it open. And then it's so juicy when you cut it open.
Right.
And nothing ever leaks out onto the plate after you've used that technique to cook your steak and then rest it for 5 minutes.
Yeah. It's a funny one because if you read any quasi-serious piece of food writing or food instruction, like it's immediately and obviously debunked. Like when you, for instance, if you sear a steak, say like, and you get really good browning on both sides, it's seared. Mm-hmm. And so in theory, or the theory is that now the juices are sealed in, but if you put it back in the pan, it still sizzles, which still means that there's moisture coming out of that supposed, barrier.
Right. Yeah.
Or
exactly.
Like even when you sear the first side of the steak in a pan and then you flip it, like often, like you'll see moisture pooling on that cooked upward facing side. So like, it's obviously not a moisture proof barrier.
Oh, but Alan, if you see moisture accumulating on the already cooked surface, it's time to get that steak off the pan.
That's true.
Buddy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That means you're quickly moving past medium at that point. Yeah. I mean, why do you think, I guess I can understand how someone could logically, like,
it's an appealing idea.
There's something intuitive about it. Like intuitively, like it sort of makes sense, but like, if you take any time to observe what actually happens when you do that, it becomes pretty obvious pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. So why do you think that it spreads so much?
So after, like, I think that was the example that we gave when we were first, like when one or the other of us first floated the idea of the topic. And yeah, I was familiar with the myth, but I dug into some of my favorite references to see what they had to say about it. And the gist of what I read, say like in Harold McGee, is that it was a theory, or it was an idea that was put forward in the mid 19th century by a food scientist. And it was adopted wholesale by people as important as Escoffier. An entire, like multiple generations of cooks, took it as, I guess, as a rote lesson, because someone like Escoffier said it was true. And so it was just repeated down the generations until our time, even though there were, like McGee says that there were like published papers in 1930 talking about how untrue it is.
It's just not true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And actually it's an important myth because it's even mentioned, in J. Kenji Lopez Alt, in his book, Food Lab. Is that what it's called?
Oh, do you have his book?
Yeah. And actually I can't claim to have read it cover to cover, but it was given to me as a gift. Thank you, Lorena. And sweet. In his introduction, that's one of the first things he talks about is, he was reading Harold McGee, and Harold McGee like called out what a sham the idea of sealing in juices with searing is. And it kind of, it blew Kenji's mind and kind of set him down this pathway to being a little bit more critical and experimental, or I guess scientific, in his cooking. Mm-hmm. So it was like a real touch point for him.
So that's sort of like his, that was kind of like a moment of revelation for him that turned him into like super Kenji that he is.
Yes. Yeah.
Now?
Yeah.
Wow. That's interesting.
So yeah,
that guy is definitely one of the sort of like more prominent, more famous kind of evidence-based like recipe generation kind of powerhouses in like the, I guess, popular cooking culture.
Yep.
These days.
Yep. Absolutely.
Cool. Yeah. Well, that's fascinating. But you still sear your steak. So yeah, I mean, I guess on that one, you're correct, Alan.
Yeah. So that's what I mentioned, like ones where like it's a good technique and you should keep doing it. But the reasons in that myth are not true at all. And of course I think a lot of the myths that I could think of, actually had to do with a misunderstanding of the nature and the behavior of meat.
Right.
And so like, it is a good idea to sear your steaks because it develops a beautiful color and a great flavor. Obligatory mentioning of the phrase Maillard reaction. There you go. but yeah, it definitely does not seal in juices. The analogy to cauterizing a wound is very appealing, but that's not, just not how meat behaves at all.
Yeah.
And a lot of the other myths that I could think of had to do with a mistaken understanding of, or maybe a misapplication of the idea of osmosis, like the idea that when you apply salt to something, that water is just going to start pouring out of it. So, which again is an appealing idea, but like that only applies that only applies when you're talking about semi-permeable membranes, like in cell structure. But meat, for instance, is made of muscle fibers that are bound by connective tissue. So when you apply salt to meat, it doesn't mean that water is going to rush out of them to try and equalize the salt concentration.
Right.
Which is another, like, so I'll just go on to the next myth. Like one that I think is not as widely known, but might be more pernicious than the searing in the juices myth, is that you should not season meat before you sear it. Because
you mean like a long time before you sear it, or do you mean at all?
I've heard it both ways, but say, yeah, a long time before you sear it, because I've heard people say a long time before you sear it, because if you apply salt to meat, the myth says that moisture will start pooling on the surface of the meat, and that when you go to sear that meat, the moisture is going to, you know, drop your cooking temperature and you won't get a good sear.
Oh, okay.
But that's another one that's just like so easy to see is false. If you pre-season, if you season a steak an hour before you cook it, it does not weep a whole bunch of moisture onto the plate. There might be some on the surface.
I think it may, maybe it depends on the steak. Like if it's a really good steak and it's a fresh steak. But I think like in the case of like a lot of meat that's either been sitting at like really low refrigerated temperatures or has been like frozen and thawed, in some of those cases, I think like, and especially in the frozen and thawed case, I think you get a lot of like cell wall breakage, and in which case I think that applying salt can cause moisture to weep out of it, but
to the point that it doesn't sear properly.
Well, I mean, that part of it, I just find like, I mean, like if you can see that there's moisture on the surface of your meat and you think that the having the moisture on the surface of your meat is going to affect how it sears, then
do you have a
remove
paper towel?
That moisture?
Yeah. Yes.
Like,
yeah.
That just seems like that just seems like that part of the myth. I mean, that's definitely true. I think that having water on the outside of your whatever it is that you're cooking makes it harder for you to get contact between like a hot surface and whatever you're trying to cook. And that's why it's good cooking practice to dry off products that you want to like try and brown really quickly or cook at high heat in oil. You know,
and I think that would be, you would find that in any kind of classic sort, like say Julia Child. I think like if you look at a Julia Child recipe for a beef stew, like it would say to pat the meat dry before you seared. Yeah.
And I think like any recipe that I would ever take seriously would mention that, you know, like it's just, it just makes sense. And I think that like, you know, if you follow the logic of the myth, the way that you laid it out, if the idea is that you shouldn't salt your meat ahead because there's going to be liquid on your steak, and then because you know, like if it then follows that having that liquid on your steak is, you know, in some way bad. And I'm assuming that the person who, is using or who is like believing that this myth is true, they must agree with the idea that having the moisture on the product is going to be detrimental. And so I don't understand why anyone in that case wouldn't just then remove it.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. It seems really counterintuitive to me, but
it's interesting that you mention like maybe the quality of the meat or how the meat has been stored affecting how much water it releases when in contact with salt.
Yeah, well, like in the other case of that, like that's quite obvious, is like meat that's been like dry aged or something, so that some of the moisture has already left it, you know, like you're going to get a lot less you know, moisture coming out of meat that's been dry aged than you would out of something that hasn't.
Like I teach some classes on charcuterie, and we make really simple bacon and ham. And that's something that comes up almost every class, is when we, like when we apply the salt to the pork belly to make bacon, someone will comment about like, you know, having to keep it in a bag because like of all the moisture that's going to come out of the meat because there's so much salt on it.
Okay.
But the reality is that there's almost like there's very little moisture that, especially pork belly, there's very little moisture that comes out, even when there's a high.
Definitely out of the fat portion. Like you're not really going to get any, there's no reaction between the salt and the fat that's going to pull water or moisture out of the fat.
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah, that's like a blood from stone kind of situation. But even like a lean, say like making brisola and you have lean beef and lots of salt, it doesn't actually draw that much moisture out of the meat. I did I actually don't know what it's called, a masterclass, a hands-on, some kind of like instructional weekend with a butcher from Austria. And it was about breaking down and processing Mangalitsa pigs, which is a breed of pig from Austria and Hungary. And he said when he's making charcuterie and like dry cured items like Speck, he salts the meat and leaves it overnight on his counter. And if there is any liquid pooled in the morning, then he says that the meat has not, like the animal was not treated properly during, like at the abattoir, that there's something wrong with the meat and that it was mishandled.
Right, like it's bruised or something. And so like the cell walls are broken or something like that. Is that
Something like that. Like I think he was talking specifically about the death of the animal and whether or not it was killed humanely and properly. But yeah, sorry. So, and I don't have any evidence. That was just one man speaking, but so it was interesting that you mentioned the quality of the meat in that regard.
I got one more thing to run by you about this particular myth. You've made Gravlax before, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, the process of making Gravlax is you take a piece of salmon and then you basically pack it with salt and sugar and some other aromatic ingredients to give it a flavor and cure it. And like the procedure that I've used and, you know, like mostly how I've seen it done is you pack it and then you either, wrap it tightly in saran wrap or like pack it in a plastic bag or something like that. Mm-hmm. And definitely in that situation, you know, like oftentimes I'll see liquid, and granted it takes a long time, like a couple days for, you know, actual liquid to start forming. But over a period of time, the dry cure that you packed onto it definitely starts to get wet and dissolve, and then
and it makes, you know, it starts kind of brine, right?
Yeah. So I mean that moisture is coming from somewhere, and then definitely when you take out your Gravlax after the cure, like parts where it's quite thin, it can be fairly dehydrated from that curing process. And so I mean in that circumstance, definitely some moisture's coming out of the salmon in that case, but like so what would you say about that? Like is it like what part of the myth is false if like the salt is actually drawing out moisture, you know, like
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't actually know if it, like the only two variables I can think of are, it's got to be either the nature of the fish meat or it has to be the salt concentration used. And so I think I'm kind of pulling this out of the very farthest back part of my brain, but I think that an equilibrium cure for a piece of pork is something like 2.5% of the weight of the meat.
Okay, yeah.
Whereas Gravlax is salted much more aggressively for a really rapid cure, true, like I think 5%. I don't actually know if those numbers
at least 5%, right? I think in a lot of cases,
So I don't know if those are the only two variables I can think of that would make it different.
Right. Because in that curing process, there's definitely some exchange, like the salt and the sugar do somehow make their way into the meat.
Yeah.
So I don't know if like it's osmosis through the cell walls, where there's that exchange because there's a high density of salt on the outside and eventually it has to try to equalize.
Right.
But
it was maybe dangerous territory for me to bring up the charcuterie like the curing meat version. Cause like the original myth is like, don't season your steak.
Right. Right.
Which is much less than I hope, much less than 2.5 or 5% by weight, because it will ruin your sear. I only brought up the charcuterie because of your mention of how much moisture comes out of mishandled meat.
Right.
But yeah, I understand your point for sure. there certainly is some kind of osmosis happening, some kind of osmotic action happening. Yeah.
Anyway, if we get back to the myth,
yeah.
If you believe in this myth and you see some liquid on your steak, just take it off.
Yeah.
Use a paper towel, use a kitchen towel, do whatever you got to do, but make sure your steak is dry before it hits the pan. Mm-hmm. I always season my steaks ahead. I don't know. I have heard some things about how it, you know, can change the texture of the meat a little, like to make the surface of it seem a little bit tougher.
Oh yeah.
But I don't know. I just like having it. It feels to me like when I season my steak ahead, like the seasoning of the meat is like more even.
Yeah. It's a tricky thing. Like that's exactly how I feel too. Like if I'm left to my own devices, I like to season the meat well ahead and actually wait for the salt that I use. Like I wait until I can't see the salt anymore. Like the salt has dissolved over the surface of the meat, and it tastes much more evenly seasoned, like throughout, if it's like a chicken breast or whatever, like throughout the entirety of the meat. I don't know if it's scientifically accurate to say that the salt actually penetrates all the way to the middle of a chicken breast just by being seasoned for an hour, but it certainly tastes that.
Almost certainly not. In fact, I read a bunch of stuff while we were preparing for this that says that, you know, it's in most cases of like marination, which is sort of like what I would consider that to be, that like even in long marinades, it take like in most cases the marinade never the flavors of the marinade and the salt also often don't penetrate all the way to the center of the product that you're trying to marinate.
And it's something like it's millimeters over days kind of thing is how a marinade penetrates is what I've read. Mm-hmm. And there's actually, it's like, we're talking about this and I enjoy the conversation, but there are entire books on what we're talking about. And one of the most important ones is Molecular Gastronomy by Hervé T, who has chapters on this very problem, phenomenal, if you want to call it that.
Yeah.
And he insists that even if you like, he has more resources at his disposal than us. And so he can like season a steak and then look at it with an electron microscope or something. And he insists that the salt does not penetrate much beyond the surface. But it certainly tastes like it does. So who cares?
Right. Yeah, exactly. The perception is that it does. And I think maybe part of the reason why that is the case is that like once the salt has a chance to dissolve on the surface of the meat, like the salt becomes liquefied and then it can more easily like get into any like small cracks in the surface of the meat. And so I think that probably in a lot of cases, the product just holds on to the salt better during the cooking process rather than, you know, like maybe the salt like falling off the surface or whatever while you're cooking.
Yeah. It could like, and I wouldn't know how to describe it properly scientifically, but I have done like the kind of simple experiment of, I know how much salt a steak needs and what is it like if I season it an hour or whatever, half hour before I sear it or 10 seconds before I sear it. And oftentimes I find that if you season the steak properly, the crust of salt actually sometimes ruins your sear and sometimes falls off a bit and just does not taste as evenly seasoned as when it's done beforehand. But
totally agree. And also, I don't know, man, I can't eat a steak without actually like cutting it and putting some kind of like salt on it at the table. Like
Malden.
I mean, sometimes Malden. If you want to know my secret, Alan, actually, I have like two bags of sea salt, of like flaky sea salt that my friend Clayton brought back from Japan.
Oh, is there?
And I just, and he went like, what, five or six years ago or something?
I bet you $100 is a lot longer than 5 years ago. I bet it was 2014. But anyways,
okay.
But so sorry, that's 6 years. No, that's 7 years. Oh. That's 7 years. But
okay. Yeah. I don't think Clayton listens to the podcast, but if I talk to him, I'll ask him. Yeah, okay, 6 or 7 years, let's say. Yeah. Anyway, I just finished the first bag because I only really use it for, like, you know, seasoning, like putting a little bit of extra flaky salt on things, like when I eat them at home. So I don't go through it very quickly, and I just finished the first bag this week, and I just cracked into the second bag.
You don't, like, take little tins of it with you to restaurants and stuff?
No, but I do... I don't think I've ever brought salt to a restaurant, but I do, like, sometimes I do have little tins of salt, and sometimes I bring them around to, like, if I'm gonna be, like, have a picnic making or s'mores. Whatever, you know.
Yeah,
if I'm making s'mores. Yeah, exactly.
Is this a chef thing or a cook thing that, like, when you have friends and relatives travel, they always bring you salt?
Like, yeah, I have a lot of salt in my cupboard that was given to me as gifts.
Yeah, I have a tub in my pantry that's, like, I swear to God, like, 8 containers of, like, pink volcanic salt from Hawaii, black volcanic salt from Hawaii, Himalayan pink salt, French fleur de sel, Malden, Irish sea salt, Selgree, the Vancouver Island Salt Company stuff. There's a salt company in Newfoundland, I can't remember what it's called now, that does flavored salts. Like, if a friend travels, they bring me salt. I do not use it very often.
I mean, totally appreciate it though still.
Yes.
Bring me salt. Yeah. Don't stop. I want all the salts. Okay. Well, Alan, you got 2. Am I allowed to have one yet or what?
Well, it's your podcast. Just kidding. Yes.
This is our podcast now. This is nothing without you.
Yeah, what do you have?
How dare you suggest that? Okay, well.
Nothing.
What should I pull off my list here? Okay, well, here. I have a group. it's called the Pasta Group.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of myths about pasta. And I'll start with the dumbest one.
That it was
throwing your spaghetti at the wall
to tell when it's done. Is that right?
Yeah.
I've heard that. I never gave it any ingredients just because it sounded so silly, but is it, I don't know. Tell me about it.
Okay. Well, I actually, learned this particular kitchen myth from my dad. I think I'm pretty sure when I was young that, my dad told me that that's how you tell if your spaghetti's ready. You throw it at the wall, and if it sticks to the wall, then it's ready to go.
And did he do it, or was, like, do you have any, he wasn't pulling your leg, like, to try and get you?
I don't know if he actually, I can't speak to whether he actually at the time, like, believed that it was true or was just pulling my leg, but he definitely threw spaghetti at the wall.
Was it awesome?
To see if it stuck or not.
Like, did you laugh? It sounds cool. I don't know. Like, if you're a little kid.
Yeah, it was cool. Yeah, I thought it was cool. It made sense to me. And I mean, like, you know, in some kind of seriously roundabout way, I suppose, like, if you want to know if your pasta is, like, still hard or whether it's sticky and soft, I suppose throwing it at the wall. I mean, if you take a dry piece of spaghetti out of the bag and throw it at the wall, it's definitely not going to stick.
That's a fact. So. Yeah. But it's so funny.
Yeah.
It's funny to think about the wall in an Italian restaurant kitchen. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Just like covered in spaghetti. I don't know.
There's a doneness wall in every Italian restaurant. Yeah. I'm pretty sure.
Okay, I like that one.
Yeah, so I mean, obviously that one's dumb. probably by the time your pasta is cooked enough to stick to a wall, it's probably overcooked, I think, probably in most people's opinion.
Okay.
And especially most Italian people's opinion, who definitely always make a point of saying that you should eat your pasta when it's cooked al dente.
Oh, I've never heard of that.
From what I understand, it means to the tooth in Italian, which means that it should have a little bit of toothiness when you bite into it. It should have, like, a little bit of resistance on the inside of the pasta where it's, like, might feel like it's, I wouldn't say hard, but you know, definitely has, like,
toothsome,
some firmer texture on the inside. Is that
yep, yeah,
jive with what you think that's supposed to be?
Oh yeah, totally. Although I think we could probably have an entire conversation on the phrase al dente.
Okay, so we were talking about my myth group.
Yeah, the pasta group.
the pasta group. Mm-hmm. Okay, so throwing pasta at the wall. Yeah. It's not a great way to tell if your pasta is done.
Right.
Not great at all. I don't recommend it. This one's kind of interesting, but I'm going to put it at number two out of the pasta group because I don't think it's like the most pervasive or the most false of my pasta okay. myths.
It's less false than the others.
I don't know. Maybe not. But adding oil to your pasta yeah. water to keep your pasta from sticking together while you cook it.
I've also heard like you add oil to the water to keep the water from boiling over.
Right. Yeah. To keep it from foaming. Yeah. yeah. Which also is not true. I mean, doesn't work in my experience anyways. Like you can put oil in your pasta water and it'll still boil over.
Yeah. Like so. And the oil in the water to keep it from sticking together. I can't say for certain whether it makes any difference at all. But the fact is that if you boil dried pasta in an excess of water at a rolling boil, it won't stick. You don't need oil. Like no, you don't need yeah, it. So exactly. it's,
you don't,
need I don't it. Know if it's a, like maybe it does help, but like, it's kind of like, what's the point? You don't need it. Just do the okay. right technique. Right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Although Alan, I'm about to roll up on your technique right now. This is my, I'm going to put this at number one for my pasta myths is that you need to cook your pasta in a ton of water in order to cook it properly.
Okay.
And this one, I don't know. It's interesting because like, I feel like this is sort of like pretty common food knowledge that you're supposed to cook your pasta in a ton of water. Mm-hmm. I don't exactly know where this myth comes from, but I think part of the reasoning is that if you have a lot of water and it's boiling and it's moving vigorously, that yeah, it's going to like keep your pasta separated and keep it from sticking to itself or sticking to the bottom of the pot and those types of things. Mm-hmm. And I also think it's just like, I mean, from what I understand, the myth just comes from like a traditional way to cook pasta. Mm-hmm. Like that's just like the conventional wisdom is that, you know, you're supposed to cook your pasta in a lot of water and it's supposed to be pretty heavily salted. And that's like the traditional best way to cook pasta. Mm-hmm. But it, like in the last 10 years, there's been a lot of experimentation that I've seen that kind of shows that depending on the type of pasta and depending on what you want as a result, it's not necessarily true as sort of like a blanket technique. And I would say that like the part of the breakdown of this myth for me that is sort of like is the most affecting is that like there's also a lot of, you know, conventional cooking wisdom out there about using pasta water to as a part of any sauce. Sort of like pan sauce yeah. that you're making to go with your pasta. And the idea there is that while you're cooking the pasta, some of the starch comes off the outside of the pasta and goes into the water. And then so then you have this seasoned water with some starch in it. And the like contention is that starch can help to bind your sauce if you have like liquid and oils, like liquid and fats in your sauce, that it can help keep your sauce emulsified because starches can help help strengthen emulsions.
Right.
If you're cooking pasta in a restaurant, and you're using the same pot of water to cook your pasta for like a few hours or whatever, you've just got a pot of boiling water there and you're cooking multiple batches of pasta in it, then it has time to accumulate a lot of starch from the pasta. Mm-hmm. But if you're just cooking pasta at home, the amount of starch that goes into your pasta water, if you're cooking a small amount of pasta and a huge amount of water, is
negligible,
pretty insignificant. Yeah. And so I think that you can kind of like, if the idea is true that having starch in your pasta water and using your pasta water to bind your sauce, if that's real, then I think that if you can get away with cooking your pasta in less water, then you wind up with pasta water that has more starch in it.
I think that I have not read anything about this or studied or anything, but like, I don't think that the starch in pasta water, even in the context of a restaurant where the water is being used for many, many servings of pasta, has anything to do with making a properly emulsified sauce. Because if you think about it,
that's interesting.
Like, if we're talking, like, usually if you're talking about an emulsified sauce for pasta, you're usually talking about a pasta that's finished with butter and cheese, and you don't mm-hmm. you don't need starch to do that. Like, you're just making a beurre monté basically, or like you're doing like the Montecato, like adding butter at the last minute and tossing the pasta in the pan. So I don't think the starch, like, maybe it makes it more stable or something, but like, I don't think the starch is playing any significant role in making an emulsified butter or cheese based sauce. I think that it's still very useful. Like, if the only Italian place I worked in, like, they had proper pasta wells, like big water baths where they were dropping baskets of pasta. Mm-hmm. And of course they would draw water from there to adjust the consistency of their sauce. But I would bet dollars to donuts that like, it's not the pasta starch that's contributing to the texture of the sauce. It's the butter and cheese that they're adding in a way that properly emulsifies it, like a beurre monté.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I definitely, like, to back up your point, even though you're arguing against me, to back up your point, I think that, like, if there's an interaction where the starch has some importance in like helping emulsify the sauce, the fact that you're usually making the sauce with the pasta in the pan, mm-hmm. I mean, the pasta is providing more, like, with the, like, shaking of the pasta and the abrasion of pasta against itself, like, you're getting more starch from that than you would ever get from the addition of from any starch that's like in the pasta water that you're adding. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like, if starch is playing a role, that's like the starch that's coming off your pasta while you're making the sauce rather than the amount of starch that's in the pasta water. Mm-hmm. I definitely think that that's probably true. But I do also think that, like, having a lot of starch in your pasta, like when you're making a beurre monté, like, it's also true that having a little bit of starch in it makes it much easier to keep it from splitting.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. So as to the cooking,
not strictly necessary, but yeah.
Like, well, yeah. As with any,
it can be a little bit of insurance.
Same with a crème anglaise or something, which maybe you would argue makes it not a crème anglaise. But yeah, starch is the friend of emulsions and such. For cooking pasta in an excess of water, so is there an example of a time where you would specifically want to make sure the pasta wasn't cooked in an excess of water?
I probably should have researched this a little bit better, but I know that there are, like, on the internet, there are a bunch of side-by-sides. Mm-hmm. And yeah, there is some reasoning for why you would want to cook specific types of pasta in less water. Mm-hmm. And I think it doesn't have as much to do with the, you know, with like having pasta water with a high starch content or anything like that. Yeah. I think it has more to do with the texture of the pasta after you cook it and the cooking time. Mm-hmm. So like having more, from what I understand, cooking it in less water, because some of the starch migrates into the water, pasta, when it's cooking, a large part of what's cooking it and making it soft is that it's absorbing water from the boiling water around it. Mm-hmm. And that water is migrating into the pasta and softening the starches in the pasta. But if you have a higher concentration of starch outside the pasta, then it takes longer for the water to migrate in. Mm-hmm. And so you wind up cooking your pasta for longer in certain cases, because it takes longer for it to soften because there's starch in the surrounding water, and that has an effect on the texture. Mm-hmm. And I can't exactly remember what, like in what circumstances or in which cases, that was beneficial. Mm-hmm. I just can't remember off the top of my head, but I think that's sort of the underlying idea. Mm-hmm. Is that you can affect how long it takes your pasta to absorb the amount of water that you want it to absorb, by cooking it in more or less water. Mm-hmm. And yeah,
I wonder if it's the same, when I was at Jack's Grill, there was a cook there named Christopher Hyde who went on to work at Corso 32 and then be the chef at Uccellino, and is now working in Calgary, I think at Lena's Italian Market.
Okay.
And when he was at Jack's, he had worked in Italian restaurants in Australia. And when he came to Jack's, he was kind of like, I'm sure they made, they definitely made fresh pasta at Jack's before Chris was there. But I think that he, certainly for the crew that was there when I was, like, he really opened our eyes to some of the nuances to it. And when he made like really delicate tagliatelle, he would cook it. He wouldn't have the water at a rolling boil. He would have the water basically just steaming. And cook the noodles in that. So I don't know if it's the same idea, like if you slow down the cooking process, it affects the texture. I have no idea if that's the idea, but I do remember.
I mean, I'm sure that makes sense to me. I'm sure that has something to do with it. Yeah. Also, this is kind of a tangent, but yeah, like my friend Linda Ha and I were co-operating a Vietnamese restaurant for a short period of time, and her mom basically taught me a whole bunch of Vietnamese cooking methodology. And there are like really subtle differences in how you, because rice noodles are quite delicate, and getting the right texture in your rice noodles for like a soup or for like a vermicelli bowl is like really different processes and really different temperatures, and or like for rice papers when you're making like salad rolls and things like that. You know, like there's very specific ways of doing it right so that you get the right texture. And I think that that's probably similar with pasta.
Yeah.
So that's my pasta group, Alan. All three of those pasta myths. I consider all those things to be myths. I mean, I guess the pasta in a ton of water thing, I don't know. Maybe it's probably a good no-fail pasta rule.
Right.
And it probably helps a lot of people from having their pasta stick together. Yeah. So, you know, it's probably a reasonable way to cook your pasta. You know, like you were saying, even though even though it may be sort of like, or the reasoning for it may be flawed,
it works.
You know, a lot of the myths, are a technique that happens to work. And so I guess that's probably why they linger, right?
So you mentioned this, but you didn't really include it as a formal myth, but like seasoning, you mentioned the generous seasoning of pasta water, but okay, tell me if I'm way off the mark. I actually hate when people say that pasta water should be seasoned so it tastes like the ocean.
Yeah, I hate that too.
Like that's ridiculous. That's what, have you ever tasted ocean water? Like it's way too salty. Right? Like you will absolutely ruin your pasta if your water literally tastes like the ocean, right?
Yeah.
It's gotta be salty, but like ocean.
I definitely. If your pasta water tastes like the ocean, I agree. It's gonna make your pasta too salty.
Yeah.
But I think like the idea is that by telling people that
they'll make it half as salty as the ocean, which is what you want.
Yeah. Exactly. You know, like it helps people try to approach getting to the point where they're adding enough salt to their pasta water where it's actually going to season the pasta.
But then think about like analytical people who have tasted ocean water and understand how salty that is. It's doing us a big disservice because I ruined a few.
Yeah, well, hopefully if we're analytical enough, to figure out that's a falsehood.
I ruined at least two dinners by trying to be a really awesome chef and make my water as salty as the ocean.
Before you knew any better. Yeah. How salty is the ocean? I think it's like 5%. Am I crazy?
I have absolutely no idea. So I have a few that, well, let me actually make sure I cross off the ones you already did here.
Okay, yeah. Oh, did you have some of the ones that I brought up?
Marinade penetration that you mentioned, I did have.
Oh,
but,
right.
Not any of your pasta ones. I've got a couple, though, that kind of relate to, again, how I thought that there was kind of a misunderstanding or a misapplication of osmosis or the theory of osmosis. like the way that water and meat interact. So specifically, I wouldn't call it a prevalent kitchen myth, but like a certainly something that home cooks are prone to believe, that if you cook meat in a moist environment, the meat will become more moist. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think you mentioned this on our first episode, actually.
Oh.
Yeah, just in passing about something about teaching moments or something. Oh, okay. And like,
I actually don't remember.
Yeah.
But a similar idea would be that, you know, like that basting meat adds moisture to the meat. Like if you take the pan jus or like the pan fats and jus and you baste the meat, it makes the meat more moist, which is not really true. Like it's certainly not the case that the moisture that you're applying to the surface of the meat is finding its way into the meat. It is a good idea to do for a number of reasons, but yeah, the idea that like the moist environment that you cook meat in contribute, like literally physically contributes moisture into the meat, is not true really at all.
No, it's categorically incorrect. Yeah. And really the amount of moisture that you have in your meat is more dependent on the temperature that you're cooking it in than the humidity in the environment that you're cooking it in.
Yeah, like the
temperature that you cook it
to. For tender cuts of meat, yeah, the finishing internal temperature. And then for tough cuts of meats, like the extent to which you are able to break down the collagen and
the connective tissue. Yeah.
Dumplings float when they're done.
Oh man.
Do you know that one?
Yeah, that's a good one.
Gnocchi, pierogies, every dumpling.
Yeah, that's a good Edmonton one, actually.
Every dumpling, when it's done, it floats.
Yeah.
What do you think of that? What do you think of that?
Untrue.
I think it can be true for a dumpling, but it cannot be true for all dumplings.
Yeah, exactly. And if you use it as a rule for how to know when your dumplings are ready, then you're going to run into a lot of problems.
Yeah. I find it's generally true of spätzle, which are like the little baby.
Yeah. I feel like it's definitely true of spätzle. Yeah. I think it would be. Yeah. Yeah. Trying to think of a situation where you could have spätzle floating and it's not done, but it cooks so fast
that
like, you know, the minute it's floating, it's because, you know, it's the steam has caused it to puff and it's you know,
there is
gonna stay floating.
And full disclosure, there is a chapter in molecular gastronomy on whether or not all dumplings float when they're done and whether that or not that's a useful indicator.
Really?
Yeah.
And so what, okay, because like to me, pierogies is like a big outlier for this. Mm-hmm. Like I definitely think that it's true that once, if you wait for your pierogies to float and then take them out, they usually are cooked at that point.
Yeah.
But I also know that in a lot of circumstances, depending on how many pierogies you have versus the volume of water that you have, you know, like in a lot of circumstances, your pierogies can be cooked through before they float. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And if you wait until they float, then a lot of the time they're just like so overcooked, they're falling apart.
Hopefully someday Hervé T writes an essay on pierogi floating. To me, it's interesting because like the filling of the pierogi is already cooked when it goes into the pot, but the wrapper is not. And so...
Right. So I guess like what I'm talking about mostly here is frozen pierogis.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so like, you know, they're frozen when they go in the water. Basically, they just have to be heated through.
Yeah.
But that them being heated through and the point at which they float, there's sort of a correlation there. But it doesn't always hold true. And if you use that as a hard and fast rule, you wind up with soggy pierogies a lot of the time.
This is a dumb question, but like if pierogies are frozen, how come frozen pierogies don't just float on their own? Like ice cubes?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. Well, pierogies aren't ice cubes. They have a lot more, starches and proteins in them than ice cubes do.
Can we move on?
Please.
The cork in the octopus pot. You know that one?
Yeah, actually, I've heard of that, but I don't really know much about it.
I first came across it actually at that Italian place I mentioned, Mercato in Calgary, and we had octopus on the menu, and the chef insisted that there be a cork in the simmering liquid when we're cooking the octopus, because he said that there are enzymes in natural cork that help tenderize the octopus.
And how much cork would you be putting in this water?
One cork. Kind of just bobs away on the surface.
A cork that was like recovered from a wine bottle?
Yep.
Probably. Yep. So this cork's been in a wine bottle for a couple of years.
At least,
or something. Yep. And been in contact with like the liquid inside the wine bottle. And then it's taken out and probably dried out for a while. Yep. And then you put this one cork in a big pot of boiling water, and that's, and there's enough enzymes flowing out of this like ancient piece of cork that's been dried and processed that it's going to affect the texture of the octopus.
Yep.
I don't buy it.
It's
color me skeptical, Alan.
That's where I first encountered it, but it's quite prevalent if you look online. I looked really quickly before we started talking tonight. I thought that there was a mention of it in McGee's On Food and Cooking, but I couldn't find it. So I don't know. I couldn't find like a really kind of definitive source that debunked it. To me, it's pretty safe to assume that cork is not, well, actually say having prepared octopus many times without the cork, the cork is not, right. It doesn't play any
strictly necessary
role.
Yeah. Yeah. That one sounds like bunkum to me. What's this enzyme called? Corkase? Octopase?
Exactly. Unless the cork is made out of papaya or pineapple or something, it's not
gonna... Right. Yeah, exactly. I could see, in that case, maybe. I would be a little more apt to believe it, that if like when you put the cork in the water with the octopus, the cork like dissolved or something, then I would be like, oh, okay, maybe something from the cork is going into the water. But like, it seems like the opposite of what a cork does.
Yeah, it's pretty
like,
inert.
It seems like a cork is like the perfect thing that doesn't interact with liquid, because that's why it's used to stop bottles for hundreds of years.
Yeah.
Like not has been used for hundreds of years. It has been used for,
I understand,
millennia. But you know, like there are some bottles that a cork has kept sealed for hundreds of years without having any liquid leak out. So it seems like if the cork was releasing something or breaking down when it comes into contact with liquid, then that would be a bad situation.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. That one seems really weird to me. What about this though? Like, do you have the other octopus myth on your list?
No, I don't have any other octopus ones.
Okay, well, because like the other thing that I know about like the preparation of octopus is that like in a lot of cases after octopi are caught, they like smash them on the dock, or they smack them on the dock to apparently tenderize them.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you haven't heard of that one? Yeah, I've heard it quite a few times, is that like, you know, when you catch an octopus, you're like supposed to smash it on the dock, and that like, you know, helps tenderize the meat and makes it more tender when you cook it.
Huh.
And I don't really have any exposure to whether that's like real or not. I mean, I suppose like it kind of makes sense that, you know, like you could be tenderizing the meat by like violently smashing it on a hard surface. Like it could be like breaking down some of the tissues, or, you know, bruising some of the cell walls in the octopus meat or something like that. And theoretically that can, like, you know, there's a process called tenderization wherein you smash meat with a hammer to make it more tender.
Right. Yeah.
So, I mean, like, I guess I can kind of see it, but it seems like a really weird, almost like superstitious thing.
Yeah, that, totally.
Octopus fishermen apparently do.
Huh. Yeah, I was not familiar.
And then I have no idea. Like, I assume that any octopus that I've ever, like, purchased and prepared that has not had that done to it. Like,
Right, because you're buying from an industrial food chain kind of thing. Is that what you mean? Like,
yeah, because most of the octopi most of the octopus that I've ever bought and cooked, I came from a commercial fishery.
Right. Yeah.
So
yeah.
What else you got?
That when you boil wine, the alcohol disappears.
Oh yeah, yeah. That's on the internet list.
Oh, is
for
it?
Sure.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it definitely does not, like, it's not like as soon as you bring, if you have a pot that has wine and stock and stuff in it, it's not like as soon as you bring it to a boil, all of the alcohol is gone. That's not the case at all. Some of it starts to go away, but not much.
Yeah. I mean, it is true that the alcohol will leave more quickly than the water will. Like the alcohol will evaporate more quickly than the water. Yeah. And so like over a really long period of time, you wind up with way less alcohol compared to the amount of water and other ingredients that are in it. Yeah. It's like definitely, what do they call that? It's like a delta V, you know, like it's like a change ratio.
Okay. Yeah.
Where you like never really get to zero or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I think that the sort of like a sub myth of that is that like, yeah, if you flambe something, that once the flame goes out, that all of the alcohol is gone.
Right.
Which is clearly not true because you can't flambe beer and there's obviously alcohol in beer.
Yeah. So why does the flame go out?
Because there's not enough alcohol versus the amount of, so like what's burning when you flambe something is the vapor, the alcohol vapor coming off of the surface of whatever liquid you have, which is why things when flambe like quite a bit more violently when they're boiling, because the vapors are coming off and there's quite a bit of alcohol vapor compared to water vapor.
Yeah. Okay.
In the liquid. Yeah. But at a certain point, it gets to the point where there's enough water vapor coming off that I don't really understand molecularly how it works, but you know, like there's just not enough alcohol vapor compared to the amount of water vapor in the air.
That makes sense.
And then it just can't burn anymore. But there's definitely still alcohol vapor there. Yeah. Yeah.
That's a good example. Like I know like the best practice to flame brandy, say, is to like you should heat it, like bring it like basically to a simmer in a pot before you ignite it. But I didn't know why. I just knew that was what you were supposed to do. But
right. Yeah. And I think that's because when it's boiling, like it's everything's more volatile, evaporating more quickly. The alcohol's evaporating more quickly, the water's evaporating more quickly. Mm-hmm. You get more alcohol vapor coming off it into the air more quickly. Mm-hmm. And so it just burns more quickly.
So I had a couple, like, so these are not myths as far as I know, but I had a couple techniques, say from culinary school, that I've always been suspect of and I've wanted to test, but I haven't really gotten around to it.
Okay.
And one of them is every culinary text is adamant that to properly poach an egg, you need to add vinegar to the water, which is one of those. I feel like it might be one of those things like the oil in the pasta water where it's like, it's not going to hurt, but is it actually making that much of a difference? Like the idea is that acidity helps firm the egg white proteins, but like so does boiling water. So I don't know. Do you know what I mean? Does it really play that much of a role if you put a cap full of vinegar in a pot of water?
Well, I have had ample opportunity to test this particular difference. Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, it makes a huge difference.
Really?
Yeah.
With the like makes threading a huge difference. And stuff or what?
Yeah. So like you can definitely poach an egg in water without vinegar in it. And I think to get into like discussing it properly and the actual effectiveness, You know, like I think the rule of thumb is like, oh yeah, you put a cap full of vinegar in your pot of water, mm-hmm. right? Which is, you know, a ridiculous thing to say because how big is your pot of water and how big is your cap of vinegar? Mm-hmm. But generally, when I've been poaching eggs, like for like large batches for
brunch,
for kitchens that I've worked in, over the long term of poaching like a lot of eggs, it makes a huge difference to like the cleanness of the look of your egg. Like it definitely helps when you drop your egg in the water to keep a lot of the like loose bits of albumin from breaking off and just like shearing off and going into the water as like loose bits. And you'll notice that too if you try to poach an egg in you know, in water without vinegar, you'll notice that like it's much more like there's like wisps. There's much more wisps that sort of like come off the eggs into the water. Mm-hmm. And when you're poaching a few eggs, it doesn't really make a huge difference. Although I do think it makes a bit of a difference to like the sort of like glossy exterior appearance of the egg. Like even if you're poaching a few eggs, like it's noticeable in that way. But when you're poaching a lot of eggs, you run into this problem where when you have a lot of like strands of albumin accumulating in your poaching pot, so like you're poaching multiple batches, let's say, right? Which is a circumstance that I've been in several kitchens where you like you have a big pot of water and then you're poaching like maybe whatever it is, like maybe you're poaching 30 eggs at a time in a huge pot, but you have to poach, I don't know, like 600 eggs, and so you have to do 20 batches, or maybe you're doing 100 batches. Over time, like you have to keep your water boiling, and having a lot of particles of albumin in it causes it to boil over more easily. So it's hard to keep your water at a rolling boil without having a like boil over the top of the pot. And then additionally, you know, like having a lot of debris in the water, you know, makes it so that after your like fifth or sixth batch, it's hard to keep your eggs as clean as the ones on the first batch. And so having vinegar in the water really does help reduce the amount of like stray bits of albumin that come off the egg. And so in that circumstance, definitely 100%, without a doubt, I've tested it to death. It makes a huge difference. And also, I don't have any like proof of this, and I haven't actually ever read anything about it. I have a suspicion that that the vinegar in your water evaporates more quickly than the water does.
Yeah,
that makes sense. Because over a long period of time, it seems like I suppose it also could be affected by the alkalinity of the egg albumin that you're putting into the pot, but over time the effectiveness of the vinegar that you put in at the beginning is reduced. And so like if you're poaching a lot of eggs, like after a while your eggs will start to fray more, and if you add a little bit more vinegar to the pot, it like fixes it again.
Yeah, I think that's perfectly analogous to like a combination of ethanol and water and acetic acid in water. Like the acetic acid is more volatile and will boil off faster. Yeah,
that's kind of my suspicion. But then in talking about it, I also do know that like egg albumin is like slightly alkaline.
Like you mean that they're interacting like in an acid base kind of way? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, like maybe being in contact with the albumin is neutralizing the acid to some extent.
I don't know about that.
I don't know about it either. Just occurred to me as I was talking about it that maybe that's a part of what's going on there. But yeah. Anyway, definitely vinegar in your poaching water, Alan. I mean, you know, if you want to poach your eggs without vinegar in them and you got to poach 5 eggs, it's not going to be the end of the world. If you're poaching like 6 cases, let me tell you,
yeah,
it's worth it.
The other one that, again, like, I learned it in culinary school and it's how I've operated, but I was just recently thinking about that I wanted to really test it out. And that is that when you are cooking pulses, like like lentils or chickpeas or dried beans or whatever. They say like never add acid to the water, like don't add lemon juice to the water or something like that, because it'll make them persistent, the legumes persistently tough. But they also say don't add salt. Mm-hmm. And that's the one in particular that I'm just curious to try out, because for instance, there was recently like making a dish where we're using Dupuy lentils, and I wanted them to be like perfectly intact. I didn't want any of them to be ruptured or like blown up or overcooked or whatever. Do you know what I mean?
Oh yeah. That's a tall order, Alan.
So, and the preparation was that like the lentils were going to be cooked just in water with like a sachet or whatever until they're like almost tender. And then they're transferred to a rondo where there's like Brunoise onions and celery and garlic in butter and like a little bit of apple juice, and the lentils would be finished in that mixture. But mm-hmm. I wanted them to look like caviar. Like I wanted them all to be perfectly intact little rounds. And it's easy. You can do that as long as you pull them from the initial cooking liquid at the right time and don't overcook them in the rondo. But I wondered if actually adding some kind of salt to the initial cooking liquid would help like preserve their structure. Like where mm-hmm. they would still be tender, but they would stay intact more easily. I never got a chance to really test it out, but
I have run into a problem with cooking lentils in salted water mm-hmm. where they wound up not cooking in the time that I expected them to cook in. And I'm pretty sure that it was because I had salted the water, ahead mm-hmm. of time. And like, obviously, this is just anecdotal because this is like a thing that happened to me once, but like when I was in that situation, it was taking way longer for the lentils to cook than it should have. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of the opposite situation. Like some of them were starting to fray and it definitely seemed like a lot of them were cooked, but the insides were still hard and definitely not mm-hmm. creamy, you know, like the insides were still hard and felt uncooked, but the outsides were starting to like come apart and fray and stuff like that.
And actually that's what I found with like, there's a lot of sources that suggest adding a small amount of baking soda to the water when you're cooking dried beans and chickpeas and stuff. And I've generally been disappointed with the results, and maybe I'm not using it in the right concentration, but I find that like the exterior of the chickpea gets like super soft and slippery and weird, and the interior stays
hard.
Yeah.
Interesting. As for how to cook your lentils so that none of them are breaking and they're all perfectly tender, I mean, a long soak certainly helps, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. I don't know. It's hard. It's hard to make them perfect. I think like if you're like really serious about having that, be like the, you know, like if that's a really important part of your dish, mm-hmm. then I think you have to cook them and pick through them after. I think that's the only real way to guarantee.
Where's
that you're
the stagiaire?
Wind up with that
Bring
result.
Your tweezers.
Yeah. See, and I'll bet that there are places that do that. I'll bet that there are places that cook lentils, and then once they're cooked, they go through them and pull out any that are like ruptured or whatever.
We were able to do it pretty well as long as they weren't overcooked in the first part of the process, and then as long as they in the second part with the aromatics and the apple juice and stuff, as long as it was done in like a nice shallow, like in a rondo where it's nice and spread out, not a small pot where the lentils are stacked deep and you have to like kind of mash them to stir them and incorporate all the ingredients. But
yeah, like I find, or like in my experience, like if you're cooking them so that none of them are breaking apart, then to me, I usually feel like they wind up on the whole, or like you wind up with quite a few that feel undercooked still. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I want to have your lentils, Alan.
They were good, actually. Yeah.
Sweet. Yeah, it sounds delicious. That sounds like a great way to cook lentils. You got anything else on your list?
That saturated fat is bad for you.
Oh yeah. Okay.
I feel like that's another episode though. I don't know.
I agree. I also have MSG on my list, that's good. Which is definitely another episode. And I was just going to like drop it as a bomb at the end of the topic. Yeah. But like, yeah, MSG is like one of the biggest, most ridiculous food myths out there. Yeah. And and it's racist on top of it. So,
like, should there be an episode that's MSG and saturated fats, the two great misunderstood ingredients of the last 40 years? Or
yeah, I'm jotting it down right now. Okay, I have two more. Maybe we'll do lightning round.
I don't have anything.
I think
else.
That okay, that you're done your list. Okay, cool. Okay, well, I'll just like quickly rattle off my two remaining ones and then my final mic drop one. I had two mic drops. One was MSG and there's still one.
Now you're just showing off.
Okay. Obviously big pot blanching works.
Yes. I am fascinated. If you're about to go against big pot blanching, just lay it on me.
I'm not here to go against big pot blanching. Obviously big pot blanching works. But I think that like there's sort of like a perception that I mean, it's sort of the same thing as saying that like searing a steak seals in the juices to me. And that's that like when you do big pot blanching and then cool down your product in ice water afterwards, your green vegetables in ice water afterwards, that you're setting the color, you're setting the chlorophyll. And that to me is like a very, like, it's not what's actually happening.
Okay, that's true.
And
sorry, you're correct. But
and I think that like if you understand the interaction between, if you have a fair understanding of the interactions between chlorophyll, the chlorophyll that's in the product that you're using, and the enzymes that are in the product also, that when they're able to interact with the chlorophyll, change its color. Mm. And if you understand how acidity and alkalinity also affect chlorophyll, that there are a lot of other things that you can do with green vegetables, but besides big pot blanching, that will help you retain the color. Mm-hmm. Like big pot blanching is the easiest, most common way to treat green vegetables, and it works. And so like, you know, I understand, but like there, you know, like, when I was working in Europe, we made a lot of green oils, mm-hmm. and we would cook them at a high temperature for a relatively long period of time, like way longer than you would normally like use in a big pot blanching method, like for minutes, or like sometimes like on the order of like 20 minutes or half an mm-hmm. hour. And you would think, like, given the common wisdom about big pot blanching, that if you cook green vegetables for 20 minutes, they're going to lose all their green color. But you know, if the chlorophyll is interacting with oil, and if it's at a high enough temperature that it destroys the enzymes that usually destroy the green color, then you can cook it for a long period of time and really make sure that all of those enzymes are destroyed. And in that case, it can help you preserve the green color of your oil or the product that you're making for a much longer period of time in terms of storage. Mm-hmm. So I just think that like, I'm not going against big pot blanching. I think it's important, and I think it's an indispensable technique, but I just think that there's a lot more to be understood about it. That because of the types of things that people are cooking, and the way that most people are consuming their food, and the way that most restaurants prepare food, there's not really much call to like, for most cooks to find out more information about how to protect green color in food. And it's kind of a shame.
Yeah, that's something, it's kind of a pet topic of mine, Shia. especially like for like having been in culinary instruction just for the last year. It's like one of the first techniques you learn in the first semester of culinary school is blanching green vegetables. I don't think that the real whys and wherefores are actually understood by most people, especially like you mentioned the enzymes. And so like even at the end of culinary school, there were students who like they were adamant that the most important thing about blanching is that you don't cook the vegetables for very long, but
they need
to be fully cooked to like for that color to stick around. Anyway, sorry. What I started out to say was that the technique is introduced in a general way to culinary students very early on, but I don't think I understood all the whys and wherefores until I read the French Laundry cookbook. And there's a section or whatever called big pot blanching, and it explains why you use an almost absurd excess of water, why it's thoroughly seasoned, why that water needs to be at a rolling boil the entire time. I even like had classes where I said, okay, student A, I want you to blanch broccolini for me and have them do it. And they grab like a 4-liter pot of water and put a pound of broccoli in it. And then I have, you know, a 12-liter pot of water and put a handful of broccoli. And like, we look at the difference in color, and flavor if the waters are seasoned differently. You're right. It's a great technique, but it's not the only one.
And do you sort of like off the top of your head remember why the amount of water affects the persistence of the green color?
So
because I think I remember
the two things. You want an excess of water, first of all, because it preserves the boiling temperature. Like if you have a large amount of water and a small amount of vegetables, the water stays at a rolling boil. Cooks the vegetables quicker. And it also, this one, Keller mentions, I don't know if I'm convinced of the science, but it says that like the enzymes will leach more readily into that huge excess of water.
Yeah. That's what I read. And then additionally, acid is like the worst enemy of chlorophyll. Because I mean, I don't know too much about chemistry, but because of free electrons, acid apparently is like a really bad enemy of chlorophyll. Okay. And from what I understand, like some of the green vegetables that you blanch leach acidic compounds as well, like when you're cooking them. And yeah, more water means
dilutes it.
More dilution for those acidic compounds so that they have less chance to interact with the chlorophyll. It's fascinating. And then the last one before my mic drop is washing mushrooms.
is the myth that you need to do it, or the myth that they suck up all the water when you wash them?
Yeah, okay. That's the myth, is that you should never wash your mushrooms with water because they suck up all the water and then they get soaked and then they don't cook properly. And I don't know, it's similar to the steak thing, I think, you know, like, I wouldn't necessarily, it depends on the state of your mushrooms, you know, like how they, if they're all smashed and bruised, then yeah, there's probably a good chance that they're going to soak up a fair amount of water. If they're like nice and fresh and tight, then they're probably not going to soak up very much water at all. And if you quickly rinse them with water and then get them out and dry them off in an effective way, then they're not going to absorb a ton of water. And then you can remove any of the excess water using whatever method makes sense. And then once they're dry, you now have clean mushrooms.
You're not feeding people dirt.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I don't know. I find that one kind of annoying. And also like anyone who's like used like real wild mushrooms, like foraged mushrooms, like depending on where they're foraged from, like in a lot of cases, there's no choice but to wash them underwater.
Like I've been given a case of filthy, filthy, foraged mushrooms and a horsehair brush and been like, here you go. And I'd be like, can I wash them? Like, nope. they're wild mushrooms, brush them. And it's like, there's like sticky pine needles on them and stuff. And it's like, this is not.
To be fair, like things like pine needles and stuff like that, I think that you can just brush off. You know, and if the mushrooms are kind of damaged and if they're also like, you know, they tend to be very expensive. And so you don't really want to lose any to like, you know, bits falling out in like a bath that you're soaking them in and stuff like that. You know, like bits of like pine needles and things like that aren't really the biggest enemy. The biggest enemy, I think, is like grit. And so sometimes, like if the mushrooms are foraged from soils where there's not, where it's like mostly moss and things like that, like I don't think, I mean, aside from appearance, as long as when you're eating them, you're not biting into like little bits of grit and sand. I don't think that there's probably much on the outside of those mushrooms that's, you know, going to be harmful or affect the flavor of them. But like a lot of wild mushrooms grow in pretty sandy soil, like morels especially. And so then, you know, like, and morels have all these little crevices on them. And so they're usually just like covered in sand. You could never eat a morel if you weren't able to actually wash it, in this cook's opinion. Anyways, I think it's okay to wash your mushrooms. Just don't like soak them forever. And
don't soak them overnight. You know, yeah.
Yeah. And then my final cooking myth is that recipes work.
Aw.
Thanks for listening to Food Court, a podcast recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Food Court is hosted by Alan Sutterby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan and Shale McDonald. Make sure to subscribe to Food Court in Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or in your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from our listeners. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram at Food Court Podcast. If you want to spread the word, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.